session number 3994, rule 4.
Session number 3994, reel 4. Brigadier Brooke, reel 4.
Tape number 4. You were telling me about the tribal balance. Which tribes did you recruit from?
Well, there were two mainly influential tribes, the Hebriunis and the Hebrual. They were more or less numerically equal, and each would dispute that the other was the more important. The Hebriunis was probably the most, in my opinion, the most influential tribe, and numerically very strong. My beloved Abdullahi Farah was a member of the Hebriunis Reh Hussein, which was, in fact, by tradition, the royal house of Somaliland. And the Hebriunis had a tremendous influence, so had the Hebrual. I don't think it's necessary to go into the breakdown of the further fightings of tribes and the further denomination of tribes, but for instance, we had the Hebriunis, the Hebrual, the Gadabursi, the Issa, old men forget, and I'm forgetting, but there were about a dozen, 15, something like that. And of course, in your recruitment, you try to keep, as there were more Hebriunis and more Hebrual than anybody else, they had a, like any other democratic setup, they had a bigger right to be recruited than the Issa, who were a very small tribe, who were rather looked down on, as they rather regarded them as outcast savages. Not outcast, but because they were outcast tribes, curiously enough. There was a tribe called Midgarn, who were the traditional sweepers, which was interesting that they were Mohammedans, Muslims, but traditionally the Muslim will not soil himself with such distasteful matters, but they were the sweepers. In other words, they looked after the lavatories and the baths, which no other tribe would do. And in fact, one of the contributory causes of the trouble I've referred to earlier, where the subaltern had to go. Part of the trouble was whipped up by the mullahs, the Islamic priests, on the basis that the night guard on the ponies were required to sweep away horse dung so it didn't get in their feet. And this was said to be contrary to Islamic teaching. It shouldn't be done by the night guard, it should be done by sweepers. And this was largely a manufactured excuse. But you did have this tribe of Midgarns who were regarded as, they were Mohammedans, but they were regarded as outcast. Another tribe called Tomals, who by tradition were iron blacksmiths. Blacksmiths and allied trades, shall we say. And they were also regarded as slightly beyond the pale. There was no tremendous distinction between the Tomals, the Midgarns, and the rest, but there was a difference. They were not given the same influence, the same voice. They were very small numbers, and of course you never enlisted a Midgarn or a Tomal into the Camel Corps at all.
Were there any intertribal difficulties within the army?
Literally none. You've got tribal rivalries, and if you got like in most of the East, they're very susceptible to bribery, and bribery and corruption, as we say. I think it's fair to say that although the British administration was about as straight as anything's ever been, as uncorrupt as it could possibly be, if you were a complainant and you wanted to make your voice heard to the district commissioner, the Hakim Saab, you probably had to pay a penny, an anna, to be allowed into the court. Not 50 rupees or anything exorbitant, but a little bit of graft. And it could happen that you got in the Camel Corps, which I'm not qualified to talk of the civil side of administration, but in the Camel Corps you got the possibility of, say, a company sergeant major who had a rush of blood at the head and let nepotism and favour gain the upper hand. It was rare, but it did happen. Well, yes, one chap who I believe was badly treated, but the regimental sergeant major headed in for the company sergeant major, and the rivalry between the two, which was really largely tribal, began to rock the boat. And the, to my mind, quite fair solution was that both went. Virtually not at all. The only time that I've known a Camel Corps required to fire upon their own people in pursuit of keeping the peace, I mean, firing on raiding parties, and no difficulty at all. They're only too enthusiastic, and enthusiastic to the point of dementia. But this particular riot I mentioned earlier on, the education riot in 1936-37, the mob had withdrawn from the scene of the thing. They were all sort of lookers-on, but they wouldn't disperse, they wouldn't go away. And so I thought, well, there were very broad, perfectly straight streets in this mud hut town, and there was a mob, some hundreds and hundreds of people formed up. So I reckoned that we could probably clear them and get things moving, get things cleared away by charging the mob, who I reckoned would give way. And so I took the troop up to the top of a little mound, formed up in line, and advanced at the trot, then the canter, and then charge. And by that time we were going very fast indeed, and one could see clearly in the faces of the mob, who stood their ground, they thought they'll never press this through. They didn't know, in fact, that all the ponies concerned were all the hottest and toughest mouths of the lot, and we couldn't have stopped. We went through them like a knife through butter. That, and they did scatter, and that was the end of that. The thing is that no Somali, well, they all had their friends, probably their brothers in the crowd, but it didn't deter them from they couldn't stop anyway, because the a troop in line more or less filled the whole street. There was no enough room for the non-keen to duck out of the side, but it was quite a weight of horse flesh coming against them. And no Somali said, oh, I don't like it, that's my brother. And there was no question of that at all.
What is your estimate of the soldiers?
Well, I think an interesting comment is, one of the things that's been said about them so frequently, very frequently, oh, they're unreliable. But without very much, that's the Somali hater speaking, without very much foundation. And I had a general at that time, General Dimeline, who I don't tell this story against, because I had great respect for him, but it's necessary to say it, that General Dimeline, who had commanded East African troops with distinction in the Japanese campaign in Burma, was a Somali hater. He was the general officer commanding East Africa, and he used to come up on his annual visit. And in debate, we always used to have our annual wrangle, General Dimeline and Colonel Brooke, on the merits of Somalis, you know, after dinner. And on one occasion he said to me, oh, I'll concede to you that the 71st, which was the Somali battalion of the King's African Rifles, the 71st probably killed more Japanese than anybody, any other battalion, but you couldn't rely on them. Well, I think the the words speak for themselves.
How long did the troops normally serve for?
They were signed on, as far as I remember, for 7 years, and it was very difficult in most cases to get them to retire. They went on to, I think, 21, as far as I can remember. 7 years, and then took on again for another seven. And it was only when the chap was either unsatisfactory, it was a very, very small number, or had some family reason for wanting to quit to look after his own stock, or everybody had died and he had to look after the family, that a chap opted out. And the natural wastage was, you probably needed about 20 or 30 or 40 recruits a year, which made up natural wastage out of the whole of the Camel Corps. And you didn't really have to exercise any strict control of how long a chap served. But probably at any given time, the of say 100 men, I should think 15 were new recruits, last intake. 60 were about between 5 and 7 years service, and the remainder over that with a number of long-term servers. Notably, you've got a very good breed of chap, the thing called a salutary, which was a veterinary assistant. The Camel Corps had the services of the director of veterinary services, the only white man in the place on the veterinary side, who covered sheep, cattle, goats, horses, Camel Corps, everything, agriculture, the lot. The salutaries had gained a tremendous amount of knowledge from a fellow called Edward Peck, who was most remarkably fine character. And they were more dedicated. I've never known, one particular chap I remember as Corporal Abdullahi Arale, who would sit up with a sick horse, literally sit up with a sick horse all night, for not being asked to. You know, the vet had done what he could, but Abdullahi Arale would stay with the horse to make quite certain that nothing that might be done was left undone. And a most remarkable degree of dedication in those salutaries. They were very, very... I noted the same thing in the war, actually, with British troops, that the stretcher bearers were that much braver than, for no reason except dedication. Dedication seemed to grow within them. They were that much braver than anybody else.
How did you go about recruiting?
Well, about once a year, this was in peacetime, once a year you in the interwar years, it was normally the duty of the second in command, who would send out word that there'd be a recruiting tour and that he was prepared to take so many of each tribe within broad limits, roughly a dozen from the Habruwald, a dozen from the Habruunis, three Issa, four Gadabursi, and so on. And within that framework, some months' notice were given, and then off went the second command on his tour, and interviewed. Recommendations by serving soldiers, serving senior soldiers, were particularly used as the basis for negotiation. And say you find it down, you wanted 12 chaps, and you had the volunteers, the applicants for the vacancies was tremendous. You couldn't possibly accept them all. I mean, you might get 200 or 300 forming up saying, please, can I be a soldier? But you find it down in the end, and find it down, say you wanted 12, you find it down to 25, and then went on the general look of, again, preserving your tribal balance. You went on the basis of general looks, general physique, intelligence, without any long questioning. I'm bound to say that I, when I was commanding the scouts after the Somaliland scouts after the war, did have a comic occasion when I'd selected out of the last 50, I'd selected 20 to be enlisted, and the doctor that was then told off to medically examine them for normal fitness. And the Somalis in their native life wear what you might call a very long kilt cloth around their waists, reaching to the ground. And the doctor, who was a very young man, was a conscript national service doctor, came to me rather embarrassed an hour or two later and said, I don't think for a moment, sir, that I'm trying to question your judgment, or I don't think I'm interfering in the matter, but I do wonder whether you really meant to enlist a man with one leg.
Did you yourself ever go on any of these recruiting tours?
Yes, I used to do, when I was commanding the Somaliland Scouts after the war, I used to do it all myself. Mostly because, I hope I can say this without boasting, but I did probably know more, having been there for more years than any of my officers, I did know more about it than anybody else.
What accommodation was provided for the war for the troops at Hargeisa?
Quite good. In Brau and Hargeisa, there were quite good barracks. A square, all in mud brick, beautifully plastered over and whitewashed. Square with, this was the, take it to three divisions of the accommodation side of things. The square, which had the red mud, dried mud, flat surface, white walls around the outside, the orderly room, quartermaster's office, quartermaster's stores, guard room, which was always pretty immaculate. And it had a thing called the Gumburu gun in front of it, which was a machine gun captured at the Battle of Gumburu and mounted as a sort of centrepiece to the guard room. And turning out the guard, I must say, was quite a... you really did see smartness. It was a very smart uniform for normal dress. Daily dress was a khaki pagri or turban with a dark blue flash on the left-hand side with the silver kudu badge on that, and the kula, which is the conical Muslim headdress and sticking up at the top of it, an olive green jersey, olive green khaki jersey with leather, suede leather shoulder pads and elbow pads, a cummerbund, a khaki cummerbund, and leather belt, brown leather belt, khaki shorts, and dark blue puttees and sandals. Then on special occasions they had a dark blue number one jersey. And the combination of the very, very smartly tied, it was tied in an immaculately aligned stripe, the pagri or turban was wound. It was quite a business. You would need about three men to help you to get it on, to get it perfect, to exact lines. And the dark blue jersey and the brown leather bandolier worn over the left shoulder, the cummerbund and the belt, bayonet, dark blue puttees, khaki shorts. It was a very, very smart rig.
Is there any difficulty in keeping them smart?
None at all. I'm always very interested in, my brother was talking to somebody who was concerned with the production of Gurkhas. And the Gurkhas, I think you'll agree, have a name for tremendous smartness, immaculate smartness. And this chap said who'd been, you know, he'd been right back at the base in Tibet, in Nepal, recruiting them. He said, make no mistake about it, the Gurkha in his native state is about as dirty, scruffy, idle, and useless an individual as you can possibly come across anywhere in the world. And it only takes a month or two in the depot to get him to the state that you see him in public. But in private, he's disgustingly filthy. He's really scruffy. That problem didn't really arise with the Somalis. They were, by nature, as I say, in a very harsh conditions, harsh climate, no water, lots of dust. You never saw a dirty, offensively dirty Somali. And the keeping soldiers clean, they had a tremendous pride in their appearance. And keeping them clean and smart was no problem at all.
What was their diet?
Well, that was rather basic. When one thinks of what the dietitians and the statisticians and so on have had at since then, they got, which was considered by them to be an absolutely princely scale of living, they got per day, married or single, in barracks or out of barracks, didn't matter what, 1 pound of rice, 1/2 pound of dates, which looked simply revolting, dates from the Persian Gulf just banged into a sort of compress. A pound of rice, 1/2 pound of dates, 2 ounces of ghee, which is clarified butter, and 1 ounce of salt. And that was the basic ration. Then you got a small meat allowance that you ran a meat account that they could draw. I've forgotten, I can't remember, but roughly the meat account never carried more than 50 rupees in it, had some £3, £4. And every now and then you could do either buy meat, you didn't do it yourself, but the ration corporal did it, and you either have, buy a little meat and eat meat 3 or 4 times a week, or save it up and then have a tremendous beano about once in 10 days or a fortnight, when they'd buy, say, 6 goats and really go to town, and buy a camel. Meat was an extra. It was in their use of the word native. Camel's milk has the most extraordinary dietetic tier for them to kill one of their own animals. They might occasionally kill a sheep or a goat, but basically it was camel's milk. And they were... which were pretty bare affairs. You just bed it down on the concrete floor and with the blanket. And if you were unmarried, you were native boughs, which doesn't, it's not as primitive as way of living. You had your hut in the civil town, and so if you were married, you lived outside. If you were unmarried, you lived in the barracks. By more or less by election, the no particular set system. It was dished out into, broken down into, from the company issue, broken down into the troop issue, and from the troop issue down to the section or less, and probably 3, 4, 5, or 6 men decided that they would cook their own dinner together. They fed very frugally. They'd feed. Morning, practically nothing, and midday they had a bit of a set to at rice and dates, and then they might have a blowout in the evenings. But they were ate very little. Although a pound of rice is an awful lot for a human being to eat, but it filled them up. But of course, what in fact happened was that the pound of rice supported a man and his wife and 2 children or 3 children or 4 children, and the unmarrieds didn't eat the pound of rice. They auntie and uncle had it as well, so it was a fairly generous ration, and there were never any complaints about the food at all, nor did I ever have any complaints. The ration corporal was the only chap who could remotely read or write, and the only other man apart from white men who could, apart from the officers who could read and write, and he could understand the scales, and he would weigh out so much rice for 32 men, 32 pounds, and there was never any complaint, and I never met any suggestion that the ration corporal was fiddling the books.
What proportion of the troops were married at Hargeisa?
Oh, I should think you could say 50%, round about 50%.
How did their wives fit into garrison life?
They didn't at all, because they took no part. And, of course, it was largely connected with the fact that they're a completely nomadic race. The Somali is a complete nomad. And, in fact, he gets rather like the Australian Aborigine. He wants to go walk about. He he doesn't like settling in one place for a very, very long time, which is one of the very good reasons for the Camel Corps keeping rather to no particular pattern, but tending to change station every now and then. It suited the nomadic instinct. And the wives were so used to being left for long periods while the husbands went off to tend stock, tend the family, 150 camels, in some remote grazing area where the grazing was better than it was where they were at the time. And so the wives, although they had tremendous influence, the wives could whip up a bit of trouble as quick as anybody, but they stayed very much in the background. One never had any dealings with them. And in fact, there was no, I mean, as in a British regiment, we'll say, where the colonel's wife, I know a slightly traditional attitude, but it did happen. The colonel's wife would take a tremendous interest in all the married families and their children. No such contact ever existed or was sought by either side.
Were there many children in the garrison?
Yes. The average Somali family, I think, runs pretty closely, actually, to slightly the same, roughly the same degree as a British family. Three, four children, as in all Oriental countries. The more children you had, the better your old age was being provided for, so you were spared no opportunity of adding to the arrows in your quiver.
How did the children fit in the garrison life, if at all?
They were just bad luck. If everything moved, they just went along with mum or stayed put or whatever it was. There was a remarkable brand of child in the between the wars days of what were called line boys, and in particular with the pony company. Line boys were the tinies, 10 years old, 12 years old, 8 years old, who did all the unpleasant jobs in stables of mucking out.
Aren't we?